Good. Well, thank you so much for coming. I'm sorry if there aren't enough handouts. It is available online. They said they weren't producing paper ones, so I did my own. I didn't quite know how many there would be. So sorry if you've not got one. I wonder whether you've ever had that experience of going back to somewhere that maybe you used to visit or somewhere you used to live a long time ago, and you go back and it kind of looks superficially the same, but you suddenly discover it's actually fundamentally changed and you feel disorientated. Have you ever had that experience? I've had that kind of when I was a kid growing up in Birmingham. My parents took us on holiday to Torquay every year. That's where you went if you were living in Birmingham. Or we went to the same hotel for years in a row. Well, when my own kids were grown up, we decided to go back to Torquay and we went back to the same hotel. And it was an experience because I went there and in lots of ways, there were things that were really familiar. The carpets were the same. The things out of which they kind of kept the cutlery in, the dining room was the same. But actually, the culture overall had absolutely changed. When we went in the 1970s, people dressed for dinner. They brought you tea to your room in the morning, that kind of stuff. But I'd kind of half expected that it would still be the same. And it just wasn't like that at all. At one level, it looked the same, but it was deeply disorientating because the culture had changed. And I rather think that actually that is probably the experience a lot of us have as Christians as we think about contemporary British culture. We kind of used to live here, we used to understand it, and then suddenly we find that it has all changed around us. And I think because many of us live primarily in a Christian bubble and the church, and that's our primary relationships, we don't necessarily notice how everything has changed and how rapidly everything has changed. And then we're caught out and we're disorientated. And I think that in some ways describes the Christian experience of living in Britain today. Maybe you grew up in a time in which you think Britain was a Christian country with a predominantly Christian culture and at least a background of Christian values. And you're suddenly surprised to discover what our culture is like today. Well, that's what we're going to be investigating, trying to understand where we are and how we got here, with a hope that that will enable us to know how, as Christians, we can respond so we don't just feel disorientated, but we reorientate ourselves so we can be effective in our gospel kind of ministry. We're going to be following the handout. I'm going to want you to do just a little bit of talking with one another. I hope there might be some time for some questions at the end from you. This first seminar is primarily going to focus on understanding where we are and why we're here. What I want you to do is just for a couple of minutes as we begin, turn to a couple of people around you, and I want you to think about kind of this question. Imagine for a moment that you are an alien visiting present-day Britain, okay? So you're an alien visiting. You've never been here before. Looking at what you see around you, looking at what you see in society, what you see on the news, what you see on the entertainment, what would you say that people in contemporary Britain worship today? What are our gods? Okay? So if you can for a moment try to step out of your Christian world and say, I'm a visitor looking in, what do you think would be the gods that you would recognize? In a sense, try to pretend you're Paul wandering around the contemporary equivalent of Athens. What's going on? What are the gods of our culture in our contemporary Britain? A couple of minutes on that, and then I'd love to hear your ideas and thoughts. Okay, let's come back together. Hope that's kind of got you thinking. Does anybody want to chuck out, what do you think our gods are?
Sex.
Sex, thank you. The NHS. NHS, great.
Little black boxes.
Our phones, yeah, okay. Those are the little idols we carry with us.
Self.
Sorry?
Self.
Self, yeah.
Self-image.
Women's football. I think we've got to say men's football as well to be...
Fashion,
okay.
Environment.
Freedom.
Celebrity.
Sorry?
Celebrity.
Okay, thank you. That's a great range of things, isn't it, that you've identified. We are actually a worshipping culture. People worship all of those different kinds of things. They take, in some sense, the functional role of God. But they're not religious in the sense that people are worshipping, living for, serving some kind of supreme spiritual divine being who they see as being responsible and behind everything. And I think that's absolutely right. You could observe that these are the things in our culture that are sort of worshipped. So some of the things I was thinking about, health, the NHS, which we kind of is often described as our national religion, sexual freedom. We see that, don't we, in the kind of Pride Month celebrations. That's something that we've got to celebrate as a culture. Economy and money, how much of the debate at the moment is about the cost of living in the economy and what the way forwards is. I think a sense of national self-importance. We have a desire to want to be significant in the world as a kind of a nation. Sport and entertainment are things that we worship. Those are all part and parcel of our contemporary culture. But I'm not sure that people, if they came to Britain as aliens from outside, would in any way see Jesus Christ as being our God, or the Trinity as being the God that we worship and the God that we serve. And to some extent, that's the essence of what I mean by speaking about us as being a secular culture. The essence of that is that certainly in contemporary Britain, Christian faith no longer shapes our cultural context. And really what I want to do in this session is to say I think it's crucially important as Christians, if we're to understand where we are and how to respond, that we grasp, we accept, and we understand that we are in a kind of post-Christian secular context. That's the environment in which we find ourselves. Only if we grasp, accept, and understand that will we be able to orientate ourselves and will we have proper expectations. So that's really what we're trying to do. So firstly, thinking about our secular context. What do I mean by us being in a secular context? Well, the essence of, I think, as being in a secular context in contemporary Britain is, as I said, that religion, and specifically the Christian faith, because of our Christian heritage and background, no longer shapes our culture, no longer has a strong, still less, a determinative voice in our culture. The reality in which we find ourselves today is that Christians in the UK are a very small minority. That's the reality of the situation. Because of that cultural background, Christian belief is something which is regarded widely as being culturally implausible. It's kind of considered strange that people are committed to the Christian faith. Our culture no longer supports or encourages sort of condones kind of Christian belief. The broad cultural atmosphere is that it is implausible to believe in Christianity and to live for Jesus. And religion is increasingly seen as something that should be confined to the public sphere, the private sphere. It's all right for you as an individual to have a private kind of religious involvement, faith, belief, but don't bring that into the community environment. Don't bring that into the public sphere where you have to kind of engage with other people who don't share your faith or have different kind of views. So that's the kind of the essence of secularism. Religion is kind of pushed to the margins of society, is not central to the shaping of culture, shaping of public policy, etc. Now, as I said, I think the major reason for that is because Christians today are only a small minority in our culture. I don't know if you've picked up on the Evangelical Alliance recent Talking Jesus survey, but they sort of did a survey to kind of find people's attitudes. And that revealed that 48% of people identify as Christian. And that's slightly less than the numbers that are shown in the kind of the census. About 50% in the census 2021 indicated they were kind of Christian, a massive drop from 10 years beforehand. But we know full well, don't we, that the vast majority of those 48% of people have absolutely no understanding of what Christianity is. And in no real and meaningful sense are they Christians as we would understand what it means to be a Christian. They probably mean Christian simply in the sense of not Muslim, or kind of Christian in the sense of they put C of E on the form when they're admitted to the NHS hospital. Far more revealing is the fact that only 6% of people indicated that they were practicing Christians. in other words, in some way actively involved in the Christian faith. And the best statistics would suggest that only between 2 and 3% are genuinely born-again evangelical Christians who are committed. So that's the reality of our nation. You take 100 people, the probability is only 2 or 3 of those people are born-again evangelical kind of Christians. We're a country that has a greater ethnic and religious diversity than in the past. So in 2011, the most recent census statistics, it'll probably be slightly higher. 4.4% were Muslim, 1.4% were kind of Hindu, the two big other kind of religious groups. But what's interesting is also the numbers of people who are actively identifying as having no religion at all, which was 39% back in 2011. And a recent survey done by kind of YouGov in 2022 was asking people about their beliefs. Again, quite striking, not a kind of sophisticated theological kind of question, but 25%, only 25%, said that they believed in a God. And 40% were confident that they believed neither in a God nor a higher power. So in other words, not even a kind of a theistic belief that's on the Christian spectrum. People think they're kind of spiritual, but they don't believe in a God who exists and is sovereign and supreme creator in control of things. They've kind of abandoned the theistic belief that is foundational to Christianity. So that's the context in which we find ourselves. But I think it's worth recognizing the context in which we find ourselves is not simply secular or unbelieving. We're not in a situation in which it's just a return to paganism and a pre-Christian situation. It's not that Britain has become what you might call virgin mission territory as a result of this turning away from Christian faith. The particular challenge we face is finding ourselves in what we might call a post-Christian context, in which Christian faith has been abandoned by people who in the past had some allegiance to Christianity. And actually that makes it doubly difficult, because we're in a culture in which kind of people think that Christianity has been tried and has failed. Christianity is the problem from which we are escaping. And in that sense, I think the context in which we find ourselves is rather more like Eastern Europe with its post-communist context. Just the same way that when the Berlin Wall came down and communism collapsed, basically there was a turning away from the whole communist ideology. There's a similar sense in which our culture, in a more gentle way, has turned away from Christianity. And that's the particular challenge of being in a post-Christian kind of environment. And that means to say that kind of a history of world mission and world mission methodologies that are working in entirely virgin contexts, unreached peoples, etc., simply aren't applicable in quite the same way to the UK situation. So one of the aspects of this post-Christian context is our society is, even though it doesn't acknowledge it, deeply based on Christian values. They may not think Christianity shapes the culture, but it has done. And that is not acknowledged and recognised. Tom Holland, the historian, has done a great job of showing that in his book Dominion, that just shows how much it is Christianity that has shaped Western thinking. Issues like equality, care for the poor, care for the weak, transforming the Roman world to the world that we know. There's a great book by Glenn Scrivener that's just been published called The Air We Breathe, which again is thinking about how many of the things our culture takes for granted in, for example, human rights, equality, are actually deeply rooted in Christianity. And the irony of our secular culture is it wants those things, but it doesn't understand that they flow from Christian faith. It wants the fruit without the root. Sadly, that book's not available because the Good Book Company has sold out of them already because it's been so popular, but they're about to republish it. But I would recommend that to you. So society is based on Christian values, but generally our society has rejected those Christian beliefs on which it is kind of founded. And that means we're in a slightly strange situation in which people are ignorant of what Christianity really is. In other words, they don't actually know what Christianity really is. If you ask most people, particularly younger people who've never had any kind of proper religious kind of education training, they have no real understanding of what Christianity is. Actually, what they've got is a wrong understanding of what Christianity is, a misunderstanding. That's more complicated. They think they know what it is, but they're actually completely mistaken. And the result of that is that people, because of their prejudiced view, actually have a prejudice against Christianity. We certainly find that. I live in Market Harbour, which is just south of Leicestershire, kind of a classic kind of market town, predominantly a white middle-class community, polite English people. And evangelism is really hard and slow and difficult because the people around us think they know enough about Christianity to know that they don't want it. And in a very English way, they are very adept at avoiding ever talking about it. You maybe have one conversation with people in which you can tell them you're a Christian, you go to church, and then they absolutely find every way to never talk to you about it ever again because they know you're one of those evangelicals. That's the problem of a post-Christian context, a misunderstanding and a prejudice against it. Now, again, another book that I think is brilliant that's really helpful to help us to orientate this is this book by Steve McAlpine called Being the Bad Guys. And this is the thing we've got to face up to in our culture. Because of these changes, we are now seen as essentially the bad guys on the wrong side of history. That's the prejudice that's against Christianity. And until we grasp that and grapple with that, I think we will be disorientated and ineffective. That is on the bookstall. If you've not read it, I'd strongly recommend it to you. Now, how did we get here? How did we get here? I want to give a brief overview of how we got here and the factors that have contributed to us becoming this kind of secular post-Christian society. Why has belief collapsed? And I think it's absolutely crucially important that we understand this for two reasons. We need to understand it so we understand the problem is not simple and the problem is not superficial. That's the great danger of Christians. We think the problem is simple or the problem is superficial. And I think for decades, Christians have thought, if only we try a little bit harder, if only we do a little bit more evangelism, if only we galvanize the moral majority, somehow we'll turn back the tide. So let's just try harder and do what we've been doing and do it more effectively. And I think that simply fails to understand the extent of the issue. That we're faced. And that's why so many of our strategies have simply failed, because they haven't grasped that this is not something that's novel. It's been sort of a century and a half in the making that is why we've got to where we are. And I think it's also vital that we grasp that the rise of secularism and our post-Christian context is not the result of some liberal plot that's been foisted on unwilling people. I think that's often the myth that Christians tell themselves. Basically, what's happened is an elite group of liberals has kind of imposed their ideology on society as a whole and has cunningly undermined Christian faith. I don't think it quite works like that. There is a liberal elite that have sought to do that, but they've been chiming with changed attitudes amongst a wide section of the population. And actually, it's that combination that has led to the change. It's not that people have been kind of, as it were, hoodwinked. Actually, this has fulfilled what they want. This has been kind of partly led by popular desires. And we need to, I think, deeply understand that. So what are the factors that have contributed to this and where we are? Well, in many ways, the place to start perhaps is the high point of evangelicalism, which really goes back to 1858. 1858 in Britain was the high point of evangelicalism, the high point of actually church going, and essentially it's been declined since then. So what we're experiencing today is the outworking of what really began in the mid-19th century. 1858 was the last great revival movement across the British Isles as a whole. That was the high point, and it's really been a process of decline since then. And the decline set in very rapidly, even after that kind of high point. Now, I've tried to identify a number of trends that have contributed to that. These are obviously simplistic generalizations, but they just show, I think, the variety of factors that have contributed. So maybe between 1858 to 1900, the primary drivers were the rise of science and theological liberalism. Now, science was nothing new. Ever since the Enlightenment in the 18th century, science had sought to kind of overcome the sort of superstition of religion as they thought of it. So science wasn't new. But in the late 19th century, particularly the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, meant for the first time science provided a comprehensive explanation for everything. And that was a fundamental moment. because science suddenly provided a way of explaining even the existence of life without the necessity of a God. And that very much wrong-footed the church. That had huge impact in terms of undermining Christian belief, because suddenly the province of science was able to provide what appeared to be a comprehensive explanation, and the church failed to respond to that kind of adequately. So you have that sort of, as it were, non-Christian secular impact. At the very same time, the church was effectively destroying itself, as through the rise of theological liberalism, particularly coming out of Germany, the church lost confidence in the truth of the scriptures and the Bible and God's revelation. So actually you had two things going on. You had science saying there's no need for a God at all. We can explain everything in purely material terms. And you had the church saying, well, what we've thought has been true for centuries actually turns out to be nothing more than a human myth and story. Are you at all surprised that when the world says you don't need Christianity and when Christians say we don't believe it's true anymore, Christian belief collapses? So you begin to see the decline of Christian faith. Perhaps in the kind of first part of the 20th century, 1900 up until the sort of First World War, basically there is a supreme confidence in what you might call Western civilization, the triumph of Western imperialism. We are going to remake the world in the light of our kind of our rational humanistic model. We're going to civilize. That was bound up with the kind of missionary movement as well. This is the high point of exporting not just Christianity, but also Western civilization to the world. 1910, Edinburgh, a kind of missionary kind of conference. And there was tremendous optimism of what the West would be able to accomplish. At the same time, during that period, this is late 19th century, early into 20th century, in terms of people's lives, you had the radical transformation of people's lives and the mass growth of kind of leisure activities. Up until the late 19th century, the majority of people only had kind of work and Sundays. But actually, through the 19th century, gradually life began to be transformed. People had much more leisure time. You began to have the emergence of kind of sport, and then ultimately into the 20th century, theatre, drama, cinema, entertainment. People's perspective on life was radically changed. So those two things, significant impact in the early part of the 21st century. And then that was particularly devastating for Christian belief because the First World War destroyed that confidence in the triumph of Western civilization. In a sense, it destroyed a degree of confidence in leadership, a degree of confidence in the Christendom project. So all of that optimism was kind of swept away by the most devastating of conflicts that had huge implications for every society. It's not particularly surprising that the result of that was people then turned away from Christian faith, given what they'd seen and what they'd experienced. And the First World War was a conflict like no other in terms of the people who were involved, the numbers who were killed, the appalling nature of the slaughter that took place. In the period after the First World War, the question becomes, how are we going to make a better world? And here, I think what happens is you begin to see the rise of political solutions. The desire is to create a better society. The hope is politics rather than religion. So to put it in brutal terms from a Christian perspective, what in the past had been the Methodist movement became the trade unionist movement. And the energies for social reform became transferred from the church into a political context, particularly the rise of the labour movement and the desire to remake society. And in the periods sort of between the First and the Second World War, you get this shift to a focus on politics as the way of achieving a better world. Whether that be sort of socialism, whether that be the rise of communism, whether that be the rise of kind of fascism with its kind of romantic nationalism as alternatives to the Christian faith. And many people gave their energies to those things rather than to the church. Now, the period after the Second World War was actually strangely a period of evangelical recovery and church growth. The statistics are that, interestingly, after the Second World War, which I think in many ways was seen as a just war in contrast to the First World War, actually there was a period of renewed growth, a kind of a more morally conservative society in which the gospel chimed. That was the period in Britain of a kind of a reformed revival under Lloyd-Jones and John Stott. It was the period of Billy Graham, in which you had 1 million people coming to Haringey, more than 1.5 million people coming to kind of crusades in kind of Glasgow. It was a period actually of consistent church growth during that cultural kind of moment. But that was a blip. And then the massive change occurred in the 1960s with the sexual revolution. And the church totally failed to respond to the sexual revolution in the 1960s. It retrenched in conservatism. It didn't realise the degree to which society was going to massively change in its values, its attitudes and its behaviour. And it's been a process of continual decline, really, since then. So the sexual revolution radically changed the culture, and people walked away from Christian faith. There are all sorts of reasons why that took place. That period also saw a period of significant migration to the UK, immigration. So the empire moved to Britain. One of the implications of that was inevitably there were kind of new religious communities in the UK, non-Christian communities. And the society therefore became a more plural society. And that meant in terms of public policy, there was a greater need to, in a sense, integrate different faith communities. Christianity could no longer be a unifying factor because you had significant religious minorities. That inevitably changes the way that society needs to operate. And in many ways, those factors that were introduced in the 1960s have simply continued with ever-increasing speed and impact, whether it be the rise of postmodernism as a philosophy of relativism, perhaps in the kind of 1990s through to the beginning of the millennium, and the triumph of liberal progressivism as the public ideology and the public culture that we see today. The fundamental change there is that there is a shift really from things that are tolerated to the fact that things need to be celebrated. So rather than toleration, we move to a point of which the kind of the new civic religion of liberal progressivism requires that we celebrate all different lifestyles, all different kinds of behaviour. Now, that's where we are. But I hope what that does is it shows you how we got there. And it was a very long progress of how we got there, to which all of those factors contributed. As I said, it's not simple and it's not superficial. And we absolutely need to grasp that. At the same time as all of those other factors, I might want to add that Christians and the church have often not helped themselves. Those are factors that have taken away from Christian belief, but we might want to say the church has absolutely not helped itself. And the failings of the church have also contributed to that. Whether that be hypocrisy, whether it be a false teaching, whether it be unfortunate divisions and infighting within the church, whether more recently it be abuse scandals of what's happened and has been covered over in the life of the church. All of those things have led to the implausibility of the Christian faith and revealing it as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Now, what are the implications of that for where we are? Well, in terms of how our culture thinks about us, again, it means that there is essentially an assumption of our irrelevancy. There's an assumption of our irrelevancy. We are small and we are unimportant. In fact, the prevailing cultural view is to think that we're essentially dying out and we haven't got a future. We are the losers. And inevitably, in that context, we don't have any privileged voice. We don't have any right to speak. We have no entitlement to, as it were, fight above our weight culturally. There's an assumption of our irrelevance. Vital that we grasp, we are not living in the age of Wilberforce or Shaftesbury. We can kind of look back to those great evangelical heroes and what they achieved and they accomplished. We are not living in the age of Wilberforce and Shaftesbury. They actually were able to do what they did because they were riding on the back of the evangelical revivals of the 18th century and 19th century. They were in tune with a broader public opinion. We're not in that situation. We mustn't think that what they did is replicable now in a very different context. There's an assumption of our irrelevance. It's also not the age of Billy Graham. that period of kind of those big revivalist meetings, the vast majority of people who were converted through Billy Graham were people who were churched already but weren't believers. It's just a very different context in which we're operating. Marginalisation, it means we're pushed to the edge of society. We're pushed out of the media. And the media is only interested in us to bring us in to make us look foolish and be part of their kind of debate. But we're essentially pushed to the edge of the media, and representations of us are usually kind of negative. There's a danger that that moves to a demonisation. In our culture, which demands the celebration of all kinds of diversity, we are seen as being intolerant, damaging to social cohesion because of the views that we might hold. And in the context in which we find ourselves, evangelism, I think, is in many contexts, but not all contexts, but in many contexts, just much slower than it has been in the past. There is so much to unpack of misunderstandings that people might have and what they need to then hear about the gospel. The lengths of time that it's taking between first exposure to the gospel to Christian faith are simply extending in our culture. What has it meant for the legal and cultural atmosphere in which we find ourselves? Well, the rise of secularism has meant that we have seen the systematic deconstruction or dismantling of a legal framework that has supported Christian values. So the assumption that our legal structure, our basic kind of framework, should somehow reflect a Christian position has been largely dismantled. I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong at this point, but that's just a reality that we need to recognise. That really began in the 1960s with the rise of the progressive society, whether that be, for example, the decriminalisation of abortion or homosexuality, moving through into anti-discrimination legislation, civil partnerships, same-sex marriage, hate speech, and the fear that kind of some forms of Christian evangelism and speaking are so offensive to people they ought to be criminalised, and more broadly into a wider cultural media misrepresentation of Christianity. You can pretty much guarantee that in any crime drama, it will be the evangelical Christian who did it today. So you just know that they're going to be exposed as the hypocrite who, under the surface, has all sorts of desires. That means that they're the person who did it. That's the kind of the negative side. On the positive side, there's the constant positive representation of those who aren't living according to a Christian sort of perspective. So you can watch virtually every advert by every company today on television, and you can almost guarantee it will have a happy same-sex couple in it. So they're wanting to manifest their support and their celebration. That's just the reality of where we are. Now, you might think that's a pretty bleak picture. I want to say at the same time in our society, we are also remarkably privileged, and there are some things we ought to be grateful for about our secular society that wants to protect minorities. As we find ourselves a minority, actually we need the protection that our society gives to us. That's not a bad thing. Sometimes in the past, Christians have not treated minorities in the way that we would want to be treated kind of now. So let's not knock, for example, the protection of human rights, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, which are all hugely important and protected under the Human Rights Act and the European Convention on Human Rights. Those are hugely significant for Christians and churches, Christian organisations, Christian charities. And our society protects those freedoms in a way that in the past, and for the vast majority of brothers and sisters around the world, they don't enjoy those freedoms. So let's not kind of have an entirely negative view that thinks kind of, the situation is awful. We're not persecuted. In fact, we actually have some very important rights that are protected that I think it's important for us to fight for and be grateful for. Well, that's a kind of an overview of where we're at, and I hope that resonates with your understanding of how you feel about contemporary Britain. And as I say, it may well be that as you, as it were, look at our culture and revisit it, you feel that sense of disorientation and how much has changed. Now, I think the thing for us as Christians that we need to grasp is that we simply shouldn't be surprised by this. So we think about this, I think the great danger is that we feel somehow surprised by the reality that we confront. We think perhaps something's gone wrong, that God has failed, maybe the church has failed. It's easy for us to think that this is somehow an unusual situation and that therefore we should be surprised by it. I think the Bible would tell us we shouldn't be surprised by this at all, because actually this is the normal situation in the kind of the world, and it will be the normal situation until the Lord Jesus returns. The reason for that is quite simply, as Christians, we are living in the last days. That's the situation in which we find ourselves. Our primary orientation as Christians needs to be those who realize that we are living in the last days. I take it that biblically, the last days is the entire period from the ascension of Jesus to the return of Jesus. That we live in a time in which there is an overlap between a hostile world and the coming new age in Christ, in which the church is where the kingdom of God is breaking in and the world is in rebellion against that. And that entire period of the last days will be a period in which both the church grows and also hostility to God and the church grows simultaneously. That seems to me to be the biblical picture. The disciples, Jesus, they spoke about the last days as inaugurated from the day of Pentecost. So actually, the last days is what we're going to experience as God's people until Jesus returns. And all that we've described is simply a manifestation of living in the last days. And that's why I say we shouldn't be surprised by it. Let me read 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. This is Paul writing, maybe kind of AD 60, but it sounds remarkably contemporary. Paul writes, "But mark this. There will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Have nothing to do with such people." Doesn't that seem a description of our contemporary society? Not lovers of God, lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasure. Well, that's the way it's going to be through the last days. We shouldn't be surprised by this. And actually, that kind of basically rebellion against God, loving these things in the place of God, simply takes different forms at different stages and in different cultures. Actually, that kind of loving self, money, and pleasure instead of God can take a religious form. There are religious people who can be just as worldly and hostile to God. And I think we need to recognize that in the past, an awful lot of what passed for Christianity wasn't. The true church has always been a small minority. There's been an awful lot of superficial cultural Christianity, values without belief, often hiding a kind of a deep hatred of God and a love of self pursued through religion. If you go back to lots of 19th century preaching, you read sort of what Spurgeon was preaching week by week, the message is consistently, you're all a bunch of hypocrites who say you're Christians, but you're not. That's the contextual reality they had to face. They didn't think it was a golden age in 1858. They thought it was actually an age of deep hypocrisy, of people wanting to socially identify with the church but not living for Jesus. That's this kind of worldliness taking a kind of a religious form. In some ways, our culture is actually easier than that because people are at least being honest in rejecting belief in Christ. We at least know where they stand with a greater clarity. So don't be surprised. We're in the last days. And actually, as God's people, we are called to be strangers and exiles in the world. This is not our home. We don't belong. The church is an exilic community. When you become a Christian, you join the kingdom of God, and effectively you become an alien in your own culture. You don't belong. Don't think that the culture around us should somehow validate and support us and what we believe. We're called to be different. We're called to be exiles. And we're called, in a sense, to be those who are kind of like foreigners who are acting as ambassadors for God within our own culture. Actually, there's something wrong with us if we do feel we belong. And that's the kind of New Testament perspective. You can see that, for example, particularly running through 1 Peter. But actually, it's found in most of the New Testament sort of letters. So don't be surprised. Well, that begins to bring us to the question of then how do we respond? How do we actually respond to this context in which we find ourselves? And I think here it's worth recognising there are a variety of different approaches that Christians have taken. Some of the divisions that are between us as Christians as to how we work this out will actually depend which of these approaches we think is most significant. And they might all have a place to play, and it's a matter of judgment to try to work out which of them is most significant in the moment in which we find ourselves. A variety of approaches that Christians adopt. And when you hear people speaking about what we should do, it's helpful to think, which of these categories are they putting it into? For some, they basically adopt what I'll call a constitutionalist approach. I only chose that because I'm a nonconformist and I like lots of C's. I used to be a university lecturer teaching law, so it's kind of language that I kind of use. What I mean by that is the state imposition of Christianity. That there ought to be some sort of kind of state-enforced Christianity and Christian values. That essentially is Constantine in the Roman Empire, and it's essentially the Protestant Reformation. You do realise the Protestant Reformation was state-enforced. The Reformation was not originally a popular movement. It was the princes, like the Elector of Saxony, the Council of Geneva, King Henry VIII, who imposed Reformed religion on the church. That's a kind of a constitutional approach, and that is what we've been used to. And some would say that's what we've got to go back to. After all, we've got an established church. The Queen is the head of the church. We ought to be kind of state-imposing kind of Christian belief and values. Personally, I don't think that reflects the biblical understanding of the nature of the church and its mission. I don't think that's realistic for the situation of where we are, particularly in a kind of a contemporary democracy. Another approach is what we might call compromise. Essentially, the church has got to get with the culture. Change the message in order to fit with what the people think and want. In every generation, there have been Christians who think that's the way to deal with the challenge. Change the message so that there's no longer that tension. We see that at the moment with the churches and the denominations that are, for example, abandoning the biblical commitment to heterosexual marriage and affirming same-sex kind of relationships. I think you've got to change the message, and then people will believe. Again, I think the consequence of that is you simply destroy the church. You end up saying to people, you don't need to be part of the church. They don't come simply because you become like them. Confrontation. Basically, we're in a culture war and we've got to take them on. So a deeply confrontationalist approach, which essentially in rather like a First World War way, we've got to fight a war of attrition against the culture, never giving an inch and just simply confronting wherever we can. For some Christians, that's where they direct their energies. Or lastly, what I might call developing a counterculture. Instead what we're to do is we're to build the church, which is to be the community of the kingdom, the new culture of God's people living under his rule, which is ultimately attractive to a lost world that is looking in. Now, I think those are the various strategies that present themselves. Won't be any surprise to you that the strategy I think is most biblical is the building of a Christian counterculture, and that basically what we need to do is we need to build the church as the place in which people live under God's rule, and we demonstrate and show its goodness, and we both model that to the world, and we invite the world to come and join and follow the Lord, who is the head of the community. But those are the different approaches, and we'll think a little bit more about how we actually work that out tomorrow. What does this mean for the way that we engage with our post-Christian society? Finding ourselves in this situation? Well, I think there are a number of things that, again, if we're going to operate effectively in this environment that we need to do. We need to have realistic expectations. We are a minority, and we should expect that we will be treated as a minority. I think one of the big surprises for Christians was the kind of same-sex marriage legislation that was introduced. Massive campaign on the part of Christians, petition with more signatures than ever before has been gathered. You know, keep marriage special, makes not a jot of difference because it doesn't fit with the government agenda and the ideology and the purpose. And coming from a conservative government that Christians have sometimes thought is likely to be more morally conservative is doubly surprising. Realistic expectations. It's right to speak the truth, but don't think that that necessarily means we're going to win or persuade because of the reality of the cultural position in which we're in. Arguing for the common good seems to me to be hugely important in this particular context. So Christians have got used to wanting to sort of, in a sense, argue for Christian privilege, whereas instead I think if we want to engage effectively, we need to more and more be willing to speak for the common good of all. That needs to be the way that we engage. That means we need to be, I think, those who argue for freedom for all. If we want freedom, religious freedom, freedom to speak, etc., we need to be willing to extend that freedom to others. And I think we need to maintain that clear distinction between, on the one hand, tolerance and the enforced celebration. We want to be tolerant in civic society, but at the same time to resist the demand that we celebrate what we believe to be wrong. That's the only way I think you can manage a plural society. And that is what we need to be advocating for. Again, not Christian privilege. So, for example, we can't argue for blasphemy laws that protect Christianity whilst expecting that other religions could be insulted kind of at will. That no longer works in the culture in which we find ourselves. Apologetics then becomes hugely important. We've seen the kind of philosophical and cultural challenges that have led us to where we are. Those are the things that we need to address. And I think that being a compelling community of the church, that is the power of the church in this society. As I travel around, I meet lots of people, and I love to ask them, how did you become a Christian? Almost invariably, their story will be something along the lines of, I had a friend who was a Christian who started sharing their faith with me. I went along to church, and you know what? It was totally different from what I expected. And I kind of got drawn in seeing the lives of these people. Most of us who've been Christians for some time are cynical about the church because we see all its problems. But the church actually very often is a remarkable, loving community, unlike anything most people experience in their lives. And non-Christians are often bowled over by what they find in the life of the church. That compelling community draws sort of people. Now, as I said, I don't want you to be discouraged. I hope that this has been helpful to at least think about where we are and how to respond. But let me end with what I think are some real encouraging reasons for encouragement. Let's not forget the gospel is still true. Whatever may be happening in our culture, Jesus is still Lord. The gospel is still the power of God for salvation. People are being converted and entering the kingdom. Secularism is demonstrably failing. In some ways, secularism has only really been tried in a full-formed way since the 1960s. And like all new things that people try, it sounds reasonably wonderfully attractive when you begin it. But is it sustainable in terms of what it can deliver? And I think we are increasingly seeing some of the pressures, the tensions, and the failings of secularism. It's not bringing people the individual kind of happiness that they might want. So sexual liberation has given way to the enslavement of pornography and the shaping of people's attitudes towards sex that become fundamentally exploitative rather than loving. It's just one of the ways in which secularism is failing. Managing the whole challenge of ethnic and religious diversity. Has society managed to do that? It seems to, in a sense, require people to abandon their identity rather than finding a way of enabling people with different identities to live and work together. Transgender ideology, the latest front line. Again, that is just beginning to come under so much critique, not just from Christians, but actually from secular kind of researchers as well. Now, that collapse of secularism and its failure to deliver is actually rather like the failure of the church in the past and its hypocrisy and its abuse. It's an opportunity for us to show a different, better way. Our evangelical churches are growing, slowly, but they are growing. The church in general is in catastrophic decline, but that's because it's abandoned the gospel. Churches that are faithfully preaching Christ are actually seeing slow, steady growth. And let's not forget, the gospel is advancing remarkably around the world. If we were to go back 150 years ago, our forebears, those at Keswick, would have been talking about world mission and the need to reach the heathen millions. The very places that Keswick was sending people out to on the mission field 100, 150 years ago are now the powerhouses of Christianity because of how the gospel has triumphed. Let's not just sort of be so insular that we fail to see the bigger picture of what God is doing in his world. And he is capable of bringing about remarkable kind of growth. And let's not forget that at very dark times in the past, God has worked in remarkable ways. One thinks about the Reformation into the context of the darkness of medieval Catholicism, or of the revivals of the 18th and 19th century into the context of a dead orthodoxy of Protestantism. Unexpected, but yet God was able to bring about remarkable transformations. Now, the danger for us is thinking that God must do that and thinking that we can make God do that. Now, God is sovereign, but we must remember God can do that. And that his great purpose of ultimately saving a multitude that cannot be numbered from every tribe and every nation will be fulfilled. Our culture tells us that we've got to be on the right side of history. It tells us that that is the liberal progressive side of history. We know that to be on the right side of history is to be on Jesus' side, because he ultimately triumphs. Well, we'll be thinking much more tomorrow about what that means for our practical lives and how we live this out. We're going to basically do a brief overview of Jesus' parables and the book of Daniel all in an hour. So that's where we're going tomorrow. There's time for just a few questions.
I mean, if you look at Matthew chapter 16, yeah. The gates of hell will not prevail against Christ's church. If we were in a post-Christian culture, maybe it's eschatological, okay. Rather than looking at a post-Christian culture, would be, it's better to say we're in an anti-Christian okay. culture. We're on the side that our culture has been progressively attacked by the liberal progressive culture, and okay. we are being pushed into a corner. Whereas as the church, we should be standing up and say, the gates of hell will not prevail against Christ's okay. church. He is Lord, and we must stand and we must fight. So I would argue for the second approach, the second solution.
It's a question of language and how you describe it, isn't it? I find it helpful to talk about post-Christian because I think it reminds us that we were Christian, but we've moved on from there. And that highlights something very specific about the context that we're in and the form of the hostility towards Christianity and why we have it. So, I don't mind over the language at all. And you're right, of course, the Bible tells us in the last days there is that hostility between the church and the world, between God's people and unbelievers, between God and Satan that's being played out. How we nuance it, I don't think is as important, but I think it's really helpful to remember that the reason why we face particular challenges is because of where we've come from, and that makes it unique.
Thank you, John. My question's under how do we respond, yeah. and you favoured the counter culture, grow the church yeah. as an alternative culture, which I think is where we're at. But you were fairly, I wouldn't say dismissive, but the first one, and constitutionalism, stating post-Christianity was a no-no, so that's not what I chose. My question is, if a country gets to the state yeah. where it is largely Christian and must say if the MPs or the ruling body is Christian,
yep.
Would you never see that as a good thing? And if so, is number one closer to what's going to happen at the end when Christ returns as opposed to number four?
Great
question.
That's
my question.
Well, you're certainly right in terms of Jesus' return to establish his kingdom on earth. I'm sceptical of all attempts to try to establish politically the kingdom of God on earth. And I think that Christians, when they have had that level of power, have often misused it. because they haven't thought biblically about how they were supposed to treat minorities. And there is a danger of Christians falling into a we are the masters now mentality. So to some extent, for example, the way that sort of people with same-sex attraction have been treated in the past by Christians, we are reaping the consequences of that in our culture. So yes, there are countries in which Christians will have a very dominant and significant influence. I think there's then a whole other question to think through of how do you use that when you have that potential? And then how do you govern for the benefit of all rather than simply for the benefit of those who believe? So that is a really important question. It's not culturally at all where we're at the moment. And there are very few places in the world where they're near that point at that stage. But I entirely agree with you. That's a different category of issue to really think through carefully and biblically.
John, thank you for a most incisive overview of where we're at. Thank you so much. But you're just the person I want to ask this question to. Has the word evangelical lost its meaning?
Has the word Protestant lost its meaning? Has the word Christian lost its meaning? Has the word kind of Reformed lost its meaning? Has the word charismatic lost its meaning? Has the word Pentecostal lost its meaning? So that's a problem with all labels. We start out with a clarity of what they mean, and they can easily become debased because people want to join them. So historically, evangelical has wanted to identify Christians who are committed to a number of really core things: the authority of the Bible, the death of Christ on the cross, particularly the need for personal regeneration and faith. Because evangelicalism really emerged during the revivals in the 18th and the 19th century. I think sometimes people can pile onto evangelical, the language, a whole load of other cultural and theological assumptions of what they think it means. Has it lost its meaning? Well, yes, it's been diluted because there are people who want the label evangelical who don't fit within its historical parameters. Has anybody been able to come up with anything better? No. And you can qualify it in all kinds of other ways. It seems to me it's much better to keep saying, let's reinvest it with its real meaning and then guard it in those ways. But I'm not convinced that over the better part of 200 years, anybody has come up with a better way of describing kind of conversionist, Bible-centered Christianity as a way that kind of covers people from a variety of different denominations and nations and perspectives. So I'd be really reluctant to let it go. I want to reinvest it with its biblical significance.
John, could I just check with you and with the feel of the room? Conscious of the time, we're past the hour, but there are other questions. Several hands have gone up. How are you fixing
the
time?
I've got nothing to do. You're the guys probably with something to do. I'm happy to, if you want to go, that's absolutely fine. If you do want to ask any further questions, I'm more than happy to deal with that. I'm fine.
That's great. So we do have some more hands that have been raised. So shall we do that? Then just say, if anyone needs or would like to leave now, please feel free. But if you'd like to stay, John is available to take a few more of the questions.
Can I suggest we just do 5 more minutes?
Yep.
If people go, and then we'll just do 5 minutes more of questions, yep. So that there is an end point.
Agreed.
I need coffee, but...
Yep.
And those of you who are going, thank you so much for coming.
And please come back tomorrow. Part 2, same time, same place, 9:30 tomorrow morning. Okay, we've just got 5 minutes.
Thank you, John. You mentioned the achievements of the Human Rights Act and the positive things about that for our culture. But are we seeing problems with the language of rights? And how would you speak into that? Would you start to use different language, for instance, responsibilities, whether that's in personal conversation or whether you're talking about politics?
Okay, well, the language of rights is basically Enlightenment language. It's really where that comes from. It comes from the kind of American sort of Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights. It actually goes back to the Bill of Rights in 1688 in the UK and the French Revolution. So again, I wouldn't get too hung up on kind of words. The language, certainly from that perspective, is seeking to describe fundamental freedoms that we want to protect for everyone. And I think that's quite a helpful way of thinking. There are certain things that a society, if it's going to function well and enable people with a diversity of different views, beliefs and faiths to operate together, there are some fundamental things that need to be protected and that shouldn't be compromised. So the language of human rights is simply trying to identify that. I do think you're right, there's a danger in our society of entitlement without responsibility, But I don't think that is fundamentally a problem with the language of thinking about some fundamental freedoms and rights that society ought to protect. And every society has done that. You can actually go back into the Bible, and Roman citizenship was effectively a form of right. If you were a Roman citizen, you had certain rights politically. And we can see Paul, for example, in the New Testament, using his rights and valuing those rights. So I don't want to diminish the importance and the value of that. And I think as Christians, we want to say that the European Convention on Human Rights was drafted primarily by Christians after the Second World War, wanting to try to protect fundamental freedoms. And I think that's a noble exercise, flawed though it is, and even though it's not essentially saving.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this discussion. I'm just wondering, in the book of Revelation, in the vision, there's a description of Christ on his return, riding on a horse, in robes that are dipped in blood.
Yeah.
But of course the point is, it's the blood of Christ himself, not the blood of his enemies that he's dipped in. And I'm just wondering, this idea of the acceptance of suffering and rejection as part of the church's mission, I'm just wondering, do you think that fits into what you're talking about?
Okay, a couple of things there. When Jesus returns, actually there is a judgment, and there are also other pictures that talk about him trampling on his enemies, and actually how the whole church will be walking in the blood of their enemies. Now, I know those are metaphors, but actually those are pictures of final judgment, because actually the kingdom of God cannot come until all wickedness is judged. So Jesus comes at the end as judge and executes his judgment on those who've rejected him and haven't repented. So the blood of Jesus covers those who've repented, so they're spared the judgment. Those who've rejected Jesus are actually judged, and the vivid pictures are meant to communicate that to us. But you're right, in the meantime, the calling of God's people is to go the way of the cross, to expect suffering. And actually, you could find, for example, in 1 Peter, a massive amount of material about how we follow in the footsteps of Jesus by bearing unjust suffering. And that's actually part of our witness to the wider world around us. So that little phrase about kind of always be ready to give people a reason for the hope that you have, well, the reason they ask you for the hope that you have is because they've sentenced you to death. You're on the way to the arena, but you're singing, and it doesn't make any sense to them. And I actually think in our culture, joy in the face of suffering and opposition is one of the primary places where we have opportunity to witness to Christ. So we're following in his footsteps. And actually, I think very often it is our faith in times of suffering or trouble that shines through most. So, yeah, I completely agree with that.
Thanks for a great overview. I've got a question and observation linked to both personal experience and seeing the reaction of unbelievers to the sexual and related abuse that's gone on in a professing church.
Yep.
And all linked into 1 Timothy 4,
yep,
verses 1 and 2.
Okay.
And I regularly read a alternative news and information website called Zero Hedge, one word, lowercase, .com.
Okay.
And the comment section there, 90% unbelievers, and so many of them, in my view, very rightly horrified by what they've seen going on linked to that. We're all aware. In 1 Timothy 4, 1 and 2, we're told, as I understand it, that so-called Christian leaders that teach that men should not marry and or that men and women shouldn't eat meat and things created by God, they are doctrines taught by demons, and that effectively these people have departed from the faith, so what they have is another faith. And I think we can possibly, part of the answer to this terrible image that we were told that the way of truth would be spoken of as evil in the end times, but part of the answer is that we consciously distance ourselves from that without being viciously attacking, or that we need to take a very clear stance and not be seen by people in the world to be, well, you say you're Christian, you're okay with what's these people. That's my personal observation and that of observing the reaction of unbelievers elsewhere.
I think that's entirely right. And all you're really saying there is the church ought to exercise proper church discipline that actually that's a theme that runs through the Bible, is that for leadership, not just gifting and charisma, but character is absolutely crucial. And where people are false teachers or where they fail morally, the church ought to discipline them, remove them, and disown them. And actually what's happened is the church has failed to do that systematically. In actual fact, if you look at 1 Corinthians verses 5 and 6, the church so often gets it the wrong way round. It is harshly judgmental of the world, but incredibly gracious and accepting within the church. And actually, it should be exactly the other way round. We should be demanding of Christian standards in the church, and those who show themselves false teachers and false believers by their behaviour ought to be disciplined and put out. We ought to be remarkably gracious to the world because unbelievers know no better. So I think getting that right is absolutely crucial into the context in which we find ourselves.